From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In the book The Falcon and the Snowman, New York Times reporter Robert Lindsay explored how two young Americans sold secrets to the Soviets. Coming up, I speak with Lindsay about his new book, A Gathering of Saints. It's an investigation into a recent attempt to topple the Mormon Church from within. Also today, I speak with actress Sylvia Miles. Her supporting roles in films like Midnight Cowboy, Farewell My Lovely, and the new film Crossing Delancey have won her critical praise. And we have reviews of a new album of European love songs sung by Arlene Auger and a collection of contemporary animal fables. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest Robert Lindsay is best known as the author of The Falcon and the Snowman. He investigated the story of two young Americans who sold secrets to the Soviets. Lindsay's best-selling book was adapted into a movie of the same name. Lindsay recently left the New York Times, where he had served as L.A. bureau chief and chief West Coast correspondent. Lindsay has just completed a new book investigating how a young Mormon named Mark Hoffman tried to topple the Mormon Church. Hoffman forged historical documents that challenged the credibility of the religion's Bible, the Book of Mormon. In Hoffman's cover-up, he killed two people with homemade bombs. Hoffman accidentally injured himself with a third bomb. He is now serving a life sentence in a Utah state prison. Robert Lindsay's new book, A Gathering of Saints, examines Hoffman's scheme to destroy the church, the subsequent investigation, and its impact on the Mormon Church. He also describes the growth of the Mormon Church. He says it started in the 1800s as a small, persecuted religious cult, but it is now the fastest-growing church among the major denominations in the United States and one of the richest. Robert Lindsay told me why he investigated this story.
Well, it essentially was the most interesting detective story I'd ever dealt with as a reporter in the past 30 years or so. It was an unusual mystery story in which you had ordinary policemen in Salt Lake City who had to go back into history and become experts in history and experts in 16th century ink, 16th century paper. So it was really an unusual mystery story that attracted to me, along with the evidence of sort of organizational or institutional paranoia within, in this case, the Mormon Church, but some pattern I'd found in covering government and other big organizations, an effort really to control history or control a public image of themselves, which really, in effect, led to the crime.
Let's talk a little bit about the background of the Mormon Church before we get into the heart of the story. The Mormon Church is actually pretty powerful. It has a lot of money, a lot of holdings, and some political influence. Could you briefly outline some of the power behind the Mormon Church?
Well, the Mormon Church is the most successful religion ever started in America. Its roots go back to 1830 when a young upstate a New York farm boy named Joseph Smith said that he was led by an angel to a hidden cache of gold plates, which were said to be the history of an ancient civilization. And Joseph Smith then translated, he said, the writings on these gold plates into something called the Book of Mormon, which became, in Mormon theology, equal to the New and Old Testaments. And it also became the foundation of the church that was thought to be a cult on the frontier 150 years ago. And really what it was a cult that made good. It started very small, started attracting members from all over the world, and now has something like 6.5 million members in more than 100 countries. So it's been an extremely successful organization in luring new members, and along the way it became very, very wealthy. Its fortune is a secret. The church doesn't want to talk about how much it, but we're talking about well over $10 billion in assets in this country alone. It's a very, very rich organization.
And it owns real estate, buildings, radio and TV stations?
Absolutely. And things you've mentioned, plus shopping centers, great large farms, supermarkets, just about any kind of thing you can mention, banks. It's part of the faith of the church to acquire earthly tangible assets, and it has it and done so with great success.
What about the political influence of the church?
Well, particularly in the Reagan years, it's been very influential. As it happened, I used to cover Ronald Reagan when I was still working for the New York Times, and I got to know a number of advisors to the president. His personal assistant for a long time was a man named Dave Fisher, for example, who was a Mormon. The Mormons have been influential advisors at senior levels within the White House. They're also very influential at some echelons within the FBI and the CIA. The CIA and the FBI both have been attracted to the young Mormons, who generally are morally very strong, upstanding, believing in God, and politically conservative. And those are the kind of people that have been attracted to church. And then you have the addition, a large number of the young Mormons spend 2 years at the age of 19 in a foreign country trying to proselytize members. And so many learn to speak foreign language, and they become ideal young agents within the CIA. So even though it's a small group relative, for example, to the Catholic Church, their influence in America has been outsized. It's another part of the Mormon culture is business success. They're encouraged to be industrious, hardworking, and that to some extent economic success is equated with theological success on earth. It's a little bit complex, but basically there's a great deal of drive to do well. And so you find a lot of Mormons, because they work so hard, rising to senior positions in industry and business in America.
As you pointed out before, the Mormon Church was founded in the 1800s. So the founding of the church really coincides with printing. I mean, there's already mass printing going on when the church was founded. So does the meaning of documents within the Mormon Church have a different meaning than, say, within older parts of the church?
Well, it does. Basically, Joseph Smith, the church's founder, said that all Mormons should keep a record of their time on earth. And this is unlike any other religion, because it's good and bad from the church's point of view to some extent, because the church is built up on a certain set of beliefs which it claims to be true. Well, what has happened over the last 150 years, there's been an avalanche of materials that have been saved by members of the church. It's been a repository, a great motherlode of research materials for historians. But some of these documents have described the church leaders in ways that modern leaders would not like them to be. For example, there's a great deal of literature on polygamy. This is something the modern church would like to forget. Even though it renounced it officially in 1890, it's still very much a thing that hovers over the church because of the bad public relations. There's stories that the early founders were not quite as pious, that they seduced young girls under the claim that they were doing so at the order of God. There's stories that they drank a lot, and some of them did. And so these are documents that have somehow come up to haunt the modern church. Now, I will say, as a writer trying to write about the modern Mormon world, it's been terrific, because when I was working on this book, I found that a lot of the people that I was interviewing and that were characters in my story had kept daily diaries. And it was such that when I would develop a relationship with these people, they would give me their diaries. And so I could go back 2 or 3 years when this crime was taking place, the investigation was taking place, and I could read all of these wonderful things, that this is what happened today. And normally a writer doesn't have that luxury. You have to reconstruct things that happen through people's memory. So even though there's some problems dealing with these contemporary documents, they're just wonderful sources of material for me, I found in working on this book.
My guest is Robert Lindsay, whose new book is an investigation into the story of an assassination, of two murders, actually, within the Mormon Church, and forged documents in an attempt to create the church's downfall. His book is called A Gathering of Saints. Robert Lindsay also wrote the book The Falcon and the Snowman, the book on which the movie was based. Let's get to the beginnings of the actual story that your book is about. Now, this is the story of forged documents. So let me ask you first what the attitude of the church elders is toward scholarship and towards documents.
Among the most conservative leaders of the church, there's great pressure to restrain scholarly inquiry within the church. The church leaders want to define one orthodox version of the church's history. And those conservative leaders have been very resistant to those intellectuals within the church who say, well, maybe it's not quite what you say it is, and I like to ask these questions for myself. So there's, at some levels of the church hierarchy, a sense of paranoia for people who want to study things that are different from the orthodox version. And in fact, that's the topsoil within which this crime I write about developed, this paranoia. Mark Hoffman, who is the murderer, exploited that sense of paranoia. I will say not all, there's all threads of thinking within the church, but the church to some extent is dominated by a patriarchal system of old people who don't like it when the ordinary people want to ask questions about the church.
Now, the church started a campaign to buy up both faith-promoting and faith-destroying documents, and that was also the atmosphere that led to the forged documents. Why were they doing that?
Well, that's right. That's Mark Hoffman came out of nowhere in 1980 when he came forth with a document that was very supporting of the story about the discovery of the gold plates. It was something called the Anthon Transcript that Joseph Smith himself had said to have written in 1830. Well, this was predictably well-received within the church because it was supportive. It was called faith-supporting. Then Hoffman continued to produce a bunch of letters from 1830 in that era in which it lent further support to the story of the gold plates and the angel Moroni. And so the church welcomed him as a hero and called press conferences, and he became a celebrity within the church. Well, after two or three years, things started to change. Mark Hoffman realized he was in a position to intimidate, to menace this church, to blackmail it with a weapon no more dangerous than a piece of paper. What he did was start coming up with documents that he wrote but purported to be from the 19th century, which challenged the story of the gold plates and the angel. And this produced consternation for a lot of people within the church. It, in effect, he was saying that this didn't happen the way he said it was. And then the church, or I should say the leaders, the church who were concerned by that, started acquiring some of these documents from him and hiding them from the scholars, putting them in what's called the First Presidency's vault. In other words, the church was being blackmailed by him.
It sounds like basically what the church was doing was buying up faith-promoting documents to help prove the Mormon precepts, but it was also buying up faith-destroying documents, so to speak, documents that challenged Mormon principles, because they wanted to just bury it in a vault so no one would see it, so that the faith couldn't be challenged.
That's exactly what it was. It was essentially sort of a bait-and-switch operation, and it's a little bit like spies do sometimes. What he did is originally come up with some documents that were as you said, faith-promoting, and establish his bona fides, if you will, with the church. Then he realized that they would even pay more money for documents that were faith-destroying, and then that's what happened.
So he did both. He came up with some that supported the faith and that others that challenged it, and he became very wealthy selling
Correct.
All this to the church.
Correct, right.
Now, what happened is that he was working on this with a couple of historians who would approve the documentation, and he killed his unwitting collaborators. They didn't know that he was forging it, but they knew too much about his operation.
That's essentially what happened. Basically what happened, he got both greedy and ambitious and trying, I think, to prove his own mind that he was the greatest forger in American history. So he produced really an astonishing document. It was a document said to be the first one printed in America in 1636, something called the Oath of a Freeman, which was there was a copy of a document really produced in 1636 in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And it was so good that the experts at the Library of Congress passed it and said that it was it did appear to be authentic, and he expected to sell it to the Library of Congress for $1.5 million, and as a result started spending a lot of money he hadn't gotten yet, and he got over $1 million in debt. He also bought $500,000 house, thinking he was going to get this money from the government. Well, a delay developed. The budget was slowed up for the Library of Congress, and then some people were saying, well, let's do more testing on its accuracy. Well, Hoffman found himself in a position he desperately needed money, so what he did at that stage was come up with a set of phantom documents, which said to be the most faith-destroying he'd ever heard. And he arranged basically to sell it to three different people, including a person that who borrowed some money the leaders of the church helped him borrow $185,000 to acquire these phantom documents after he told them it was going to just destroy the church. Well, one of these people that helped him buy these documents was a man named Stephen Christensen, a very upstanding, good Mormon businessman who thought he was helping helping protect the image of the church. Well, Steve Christensen began to know that Hoffman had sold these documents twice in his desperate effort to raise some money. And so what Hoffman did was kill Steve Christensen in an effort to reduce pressure on himself and to stop the publication of the fact that he was actually double-dealing. Then he left a bomb at Steve Christensen's office, and a booby-trap bomb, and Steve arrived at work one day and it killed him. Then a couple of hours later, a woman who was the wife of a business partner of Steve Christensen was also killed. Hoffman had left this bomb in the effort to throw the police off, to make them think it was connected to the business. But then, tragically, from Hoffman's point of view, he had thought that by killing these two people, he would reduce pressure that he was under from the church to produce this phantom set of documents that was going to destroy the church. They were called, by the way, the McClellan Collection. But lo and behold, within a few hours after he had killed two people, he visited a senior member of the Mormon Church, and that person said, well, no, we still want you to go ahead and come up with a McClellan Collection, and it was arranged that a loyal member of the church would buy them, and the plan would be to keep them secret, and then he would donate them to the church. Well, Hoffman then was faced with the prospect he had to come up with the documents that didn't exist. So he then, according to the investigators, planned to kill a third person. He'd planned to lead a man to his car, in which he then was going to blow up the car and along with this man. He would then say, well, the documents were blown up, and somehow it's connected to these earlier two murders. What happened is that this man failed to make the appointment, and then Hoffman by accident he didn't kill himself, but he severely injured himself when the bomb went off, and he was critically injured. Then led to this massive investigation that was started by the two bombings.
I want to talk about the investigation and also talk about the motive of the murderer and forger, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Robert Lindsay. We're discussing the subject of his new book, A Gathering of Saints, A True Story of Money, Murder, and Deceit. And it's about the attempts of someone to almost destroy the Mormon Church through forging documents. Robert Lindsay is also the author of The Falcon and the Snowman, the investigative book on which the movie was based, and he's the former West Coast correspondent for the New York Times. We'll be back in a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Robert Lindsay is my guest, the former West Coast correspondent for the New York Times, author of the new book, A Gathering of Saints. Well, Mark Hoffman forged documents that challenged the history of the Mormon Church, killed two of the people who were his unwitting collaborators on this. What do you think his motives were? Did he want to destroy the church?
That was his long-term objective. He was a young man who was very bright, decided about 13 or 14 he didn't believe the precepts of the church that had been inculcated in him from the time he was about 3 years old. He was one of those that started asking questions. He decided that the story of the gold plates were wrong. And he felt a sense of outrage. He was angered at this policy of the church in restricting scholarly access. So what he set out to do, first really he wanted to make money, and he did. He made, as I mentioned, more than $2 million doing it. But his long-term objective was to destroy the church by coming up with documents that were so devastating to the church's version of the church that it couldn't stand anymore. And he came very close to doing that. If the bombings hadn't occurred, if he hadn't gotten himself so much into debt that he had to strike out with these lethal bombs, it's very likely that he would have done that. There's a somewhat of a surprise ending to the book, which I don't want to give, but that's what his long-term objective is, to destroy the church. Because it's a little bit like Christopher Boyce, the young man I wrote about in The Falcon and the Snowman. They're both very bright, very idealistic to some extent, and where Christopher Boyce decided at 13 or 14 he didn't believe what he'd been taught as a Catholic, didn't believe what he'd been taught as a very conservative household. He eventually got a job where he worked for the CIA and decided to sell secret documents to the Russians. The similarity is Mark Hoffman very much also was disillusioned by the church, but what he set out to do is write his own documents, create forgeries, and sell them to the church and blackmail them and make some money at the same time. But the common route is similar. Young people who were bright were taught certain things as children, and as young adolescents decided that they had been conned, if you will, and felt cheated by they'd spent much of their life believing certain things, and they decided that the adult world had fooled them and betrayed them, and so that was their kind of revenge.
I'm interested in talking a little bit about what the investigation was like after the murders. You've described Utah as the closest thing to theocracy in the United States because the teachings of the church have influenced the way the government is run there, the way everything is done there.
Mm-hmm.
What was it difficult for the police who were investigating this? Were there a lot of police who were Mormons who felt that somehow they might be compromising the church by investigating the story?
Yeah, again, that was one of the sort of the subplots of this story. And you had most, the power structure in Utah is dominated by the church. Everywhere, the congressmen, the senators are all Mormons. And that goes down to the police department level, too, as well as the prosecutors. Virtually all of the key players in this were Mormons. And so there was a great deal of reason to believe that these men would feel pressure from the church to, if they found something embarrassing to the church, to gloss it over. And as I said, one of the subplots of the stories I looked into was that they really turned out to do their job well. They may have had some psychic pressure to conceal the fact that the church had been dealing with Markoff and hiding certain documents, but they did their job well, and it was really sort of a triumph of their sense of duty over their sense of obligation to the church. And at the same time, there was a tension that was prevailed throughout the investigation among the Mormons and the few non-Mormon investigators, because the non-Mormon investigators thought, and in some cases there was reason for that they were going too easy on the church leaders when it came to investigating them. And so again, that's one of the things that made this story appealing for me to tell it, the human story of these people sort of clashing with their value systems.
What was the church's response to the investigation? Did they cooperate? Did they try to cover things up? Did they try to lead the police on the wrong trail?
Essentially, the church's response was to put their best face forward. They cooperated very little with the investigators beyond the bare minimum. They would see them, but they generally would say, I don't remember. They would say they hardly knew Mark Hoffman. They hardly knew Stephen Christensen, when there was plenty of evidence to show that they were, in fact, trying to buy up these documents. But they gave a minimal amount of cooperation. And at one point, at least, the district attorney had to go to get a subpoena to get the documents. The church refused to give them. So there was sort of a lip service to cooperation, but the general attitude of most investigators, Mormon and non-member, is that they had to be kicked, dragging, and screaming to cooperate with the investigation because they were concerned with the embarrassment that would result from this. And as an outsider, one could expect that. I'd seen other institutions, government, nobody wants embarrassing stuff to get out. And the difference here was that in some cases the church would cite their special nature as a religion to object to giving documents and other stuff to the police. They would cite, in fact, the First Amendment.
Mark Hoffman, who forged these documents, was trying to destroy the Mormon church by basically challenging the documents that the church is based on. His attempts to destroy the church failed. His documents were found to be forgeries. How do you think this has affected the atmosphere of inquiry, of intellectual inquiry within the Mormon church?
The church's initial reaction was to further tighten its rein over scholars and limit access to prevent scholars from going in. But I think as a result of the Mark Hoffman affair, he's opened up what amounts to a can of worms for the church. It's encouraged scholars to go into the church's past. And I think it's going to be impossible for the church to stop this intellectual inquiry. You've got a new generation of young, educated Mormons who are not willing, as perhaps their grandfathers might have been, just to listen to the church's instructions. They have questions and they want answers to them.
Was this a very hard story to cover? I think it's difficult to cover stories about deceit within somebody else's religion. I know you're not a Mormon.
No, you're right. It was the hardest project I've ever done in my life as a reporter for a number of reasons. The Mormon history is very complex, full of contradictions. I had to go as a stranger and find a commonality in the books that I could read that would give me some sense of what really happened, because what really happened was important to what happened in 1980 and 1985. The church was very uncooperative with me in dealing with this book. As I said, they just soon forget it happened. My experience, the Mormon people as a group are are very nice people, decent people. But understandably, they just soon forget this affair. And so what I was in a position of going into Salt Lake City as an outsider, as somebody sort of called me a man from Mars, without the Mormon background, and try to get people to talk to me. And in time I did, helped not only by Mormons, but other non-Mormons who were familiar with this case. But it was going into a very alien culture. In America, there's very few places that are really that distinctively different as Utah is from the rest of the country. The rest of America, in my judgment, is somewhat become homogenized by television and travel. You go into places in the South which do have some regional differences. But in a way, America is pretty much homogenized. But when you go into Utah, it's a different country, which made it interesting. But it was very, very difficult. Just so much. In fact, it was a challenge from a reporter's point of view to look in. As I'd been a history major in college, and the idea of dealing with a murder mystery that involved history, I guess, was what really appealed to me when I first got involved in the story, first for the New York Times and then writing the book.
You had once said, in terms of The Falcon and the Snowman, that you had become very close with Christopher Boyce, one of the spies, in writing his story, and that you thought you'd perhaps become too close. Was there a lesson you learned from writing The Falcon and the Snowman, from that investigation, that you were able to apply to your investigation in the Mormon Church?
Absolutely, and it's a very good question. I did become too close with Boyce and his family. I made the conscious decision in this case, although Hoffman refused to communicate with me, but I decided beforehand that I was not going to get close to him or members of his family, because you lose a certain amount of objectivity, but it also aches at your heart when you get to know people who are suffering so much. And I kept an arm's length distance this time.
You've left the New York Times. You left last May. You had been for, I think, about 20 years working for the Times. You'd been the chief West Coast correspondent. How come you left?
It was a number of things. I was under mounting pressure to become an editor in New York. And for good or for worse, I'm a Californian, and I didn't want to go to New York, even though I have very dear friends in New York. And secondly, I wanted to write another book, and this last book, The Gathering Seas, I took 3 months off from work to write, basically as a sort of comp time that I had left over from covering President Reagan. And I found out that it was so tough to write a book in that short a period that I don't think I could do it again. And so it was a choice of becoming an editor or losing the kind of, as a reporter gets older, it becomes a little bit more difficult to do as good a job at 50, for example, as you do when you're 30, and I decided I was going to make a switch in my life, and rather than become an editor, just write books, which I enjoy very much.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Robert Lindsay, and we've been discussing his new book, A Gathering of Saints. It tells the story of a scheme to topple the Mormon Church, and this scheme ended with the murders of two Mormons. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Lindsay is the former chief West Coast correspondent for the New York Times and is also the author of The Falcon and the Snowman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Sylvia Miles' small screen roles sometimes steal the show. She got an Academy Award nomination for her role in Midnight Cowboy as the woman who goes to bed with the character played by John Voight, not realizing he's a hustler. Coming up, Sylvia Miles talks about her latest role as the food-loving matchmaker in Crossing Delancey. Also today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews an album of love songs performed by soprano Arlene Auger and pianist Dalton Baldwin. They're both Americans who are virtual unknowns here, but who enjoy a wide following in Europe. And critic Stuart Klawans has a review of The Hungry Girls. It's a collection of contemporary animal fables by Patricia Eakins. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The White House today blasted House Speaker Jim Wright for telling reporters that the CIA has engineered the activities of the internal opposition in Nicaragua. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
House Speaker Jim Wright told reporters yesterday that the CIA's involvement in anti-Sandinista demonstrations was unmistakable. Wright added that agents of our government have assisted in organizing the kind of anti-government demonstrations that have been calculated to provoke arrests. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater accused Wright of violating the confidentiality of secret congressional intelligence briefings. Fitzwater said Wright was taking the side of the Sandinistas. Later in the day, President Reagan declined to confirm or deny Wright's charge.
I say if I start going down that road, then I'm creating the same violation that he did.
So are you saying, sir, that he abused the privileges of the Intelligence Committee?
I just say that it's common sense to not discuss anything having to do with intelligence or CIA operations and so forth.
Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater declined to comment on whether President Reagan authorized the CIA to create disruptions in Nicaragua. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Soviet Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze arrives in Washington tonight for 2 days of talks with Secretary of State George Shultz. State Department officials say Shultz will raise specific human rights issues with his Soviet counterpart, but they say the theme of the meetings is continuity of superpower relations. Shevardnadze is also scheduled to meet with President Reagan and hold his first private talks with Vice President George Bush. On Friday, Shevardnadze flies to New York for the current session of the United Nations General Assembly. NASA officials say next week's scheduled flight of the Space Shuttle Discovery should not be delayed by a mix-up in shuttle parts. Engineers believe an outdated part may have been inadvertently installed in a Discovery booster rocket. More from NPR's Howard Berkus.
Engineers suspect that because they found an outmoded nozzle nose ring in a booster rocket they test-fired last month. The ring was redesigned before the Challenger accident, and no old versions of them are supposed to be used. Engineers fear that an outdated ring was also placed in one of the boosters now attached to the Space Shuttle Discovery. They're trying to figure out whether the right rings went into Discovery's boosters, but they may not be able to tell for sure. So officials are gathering all test and performance data for the older design. They say the older rings have always worked well and would not threaten the safety of the Discovery flight. A special meeting of high-level NASA officials has been scheduled next week to consider the problem. NASA officials say now that this mix-up should not delay the Discovery flight, but they say it raises serious questions about the quality control systems at NASA and at booster maker Morton Thiokol. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
Housing starts in August fell 3.3%. The drop last month follows two straight increases in June and July. Walter Maloney of the National Association of Realtors says he's not surprised by today's Commerce Department report.
The slight decline we've seen in housing starts is to a level that's about what we're expecting for this year. We're looking for declining activity now, and we're looking for next year's housing starts rate to be down a little further, primarily because we've had an overall increase in mortgage rates recently. We've had a lot of demand filled, particularly in the new housing market.
Consumer prices rose 0.4% in August. Increases in food prices, many of which were caused by the summer drought, as well as higher housing and energy costs, accounted for more than 80% of the latest rise. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 3 points to close at 2090.50. Declines led advances on volume of 128 million shares. Average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 4 cents. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Soprano Arlene Auger and pianist Dalton Baldwin are both Americans who have won more recognition in Europe than at home. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of their new album of love songs, which he says should make U.S. audiences take notice.
The soprano voice of Arlene Auger is one of the loveliest on the international concert and opera scene. It has something of the sweet cream richness of Dame Kiri Tekonawa. And Auger, too, made one of her most significant appearances singing at a British royal wedding. She's the only American ever to do so, the wedding of Prince Andrew and Fergie. But Auger is a more adventurous singer than Tekonawa, and a more sensitive one. Her new album on the Delos label, called Love Songs, has an ominously icky cover, a clean-cut, preppy couple with their arms around each other in a field of wildflowers. But the 25 selections on the CD have been chosen with more care and intelligence than the usual recital of love songs. There are songs in German, French, Spanish, and Portuguese, besides the 10 in English. There are relatively familiar songs by Schumann, Mahler, and Richard Strauss, and some unjustly neglected songs by Aaron Copland, a Stephen Foster gem called Why No One to Love, and songs by Roger Quilter, Frank Bridge, and Charles Gounod, the composer of this forgotten, enchanting serenade. There's a dreadfully derivative, practically anonymous setting of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's How Do I Love Thee, Let Me Count the Ways by Edouard Lippay, who was head vocal coach at MGM during the Jeanette MacDonald Nelson Eddy days. Eddy was one of Lippay's students. You might want to program your CD player to skip over this band after you've heard it once. But there are also several theater songs that Auger seems to have special affinity for. Noel Coward's I'll Follow My Secret Heart, and Lerner and Lowe's Before I Gaze at You Again, Guinevere's Farewell to Lancelot in Camelot, which Auger turns into one of the most touching art songs on the album.
Turn to years. I have so much forgetting to know before.
Auger's accompanist is the estimable and elegant Dalton Baldwin, probably best known for his collaborations with French tenor Gerard Souzet, as well as his work with sopranos Ellie Ameling and Jesse Norman. But this album of love songs also reveals some of Auger's limitations, and perhaps helps to explain why she isn't more of a superstar than she is. For all the intelligence and sensitivity, the gift for languages and good diction, though she does tend to alter vowels to make her high notes come out easier, and the sheer loveliness of her sound, she tends to sing each of these 25 selections with a certain sameness, a sameness of both mood and vocal color. Everything is lovely, in fact, extremely lovely, but nothing makes you jump with excitement or melts you with charm or breaks your heart. Except for maybe the Stephen Foster and the Camelot number, few of the selections haunt my memory or infiltrate my sleep. Still, Auger is one of our most valuable performers, even if she has yet to become one of our most cherishable.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new album of love songs performed by Arlene Auger and Dalton Baldwin on the Delos label. This is Fresh Air. Actress Sylvia Miles is not afraid to take on film parts some actresses might shy away from. She won an Academy Award nomination for her role in the film Midnight Cowboy. She played an older woman who sleeps with a young hustler, played by John Voight. She played nude scenes in the Andy Warhol-Paul Morrissey underground film Heat. In the new film Crossing Delancey, Miles plays a Jewish matchmaker trying to fix up Sam, a pickle vendor from the Lower East Side, with Isabel, an Upper West Side woman involved in the literary scene. The matchmaker introduces the pair at the apartment of Isabel's grandmother, where both the grandmother and the matchmaker push Sam and Isabel to go out on a date.
Sam, what's the plan?
Well, I thought Saturday night, if you're free, I could take Isabel to dinner.
My cousin Mishka, the Romanian palace. He'll take good care of you.
Thank you, but I don't think so.
What's this?
It's been lovely meeting you, Sam, and I appreciate your kind invitation, but I don't think I want to go. Thank you very much.
Well, she spoke. You look, you meet, you try, you see. Sometimes it fits, sometimes it don't.
I play a marriage broker, actually. The Yiddish expression, it's called a shotgun, which in Fiddler on the Roof, if you recall, was called the Yenter, right? So it's a character that one wouldn't think would be, you know, alive and contemporaneous right now. But for some strange reason, it is, because in the crazy world that we live in, the idea of a marriage broker is actually a very practical idea.
Well, you play a yenta in two senses of the word. One is that, you know, you're the marriage broker, but also you're the kind of neighborhood gossip who's
Absolutely.
Very loud, always talking.
Well, I think vivacious, let me put it
okay.
this way. More than
Oh, and I should add, always stuffing her face.
Absolutely.
Talking loudly while loading the food in.
Did you ever see so much food being consumed? I gained 11 pounds. After that shoot.
You ate great in that movie, though. I loved your eating in it.
I've been keeping in very close contact with the prop girl who did the cooking. I think she should become a chef.
So tell me, what kind of research did you have to do to learn how to be a yenta and to learn how to eat like that?
Well, actually, you know, I'm a native-born New Yorker, and downtown has been my home all my life, Greenwich Village and Lower Manhattan. And it sort of gets into your bones. But somehow or other, it was all there, and it just all came out, you know. It's a character, by the way, that I think all over the country everybody will identify with, much like the character that I did in Wall Street, the real estate broker, is a very identifiable, recognizable character. And I don't mind playing those roles, and I don't feel in any way that it's caricature at all.
In the film Midnight Cowboy, you had a small role, but it was a real standout part that won you an Academy Award nomination. John Voight picks you up, and you don't know he's a hustler. You don't know he's going to want to charge you.
Straighten out the bed for me, will you, Tex?
Say, Chaos, I sure have enjoyed being here. I believe it's as fine a time as I've ever had in my damn life.
Me too, lover.
Almost hate to bring up business.
Yeah, it's murder, isn't it? Listen, sweetie, why don't you run along and take the number, and we're going to get in touch with each other real soon, aren't we? Would you believe that? I forgot to get to the bank, and now it's too late. Listen, I have to take a taxi. I need a few bucks. I hate to ask you, but you're such a doll.
You know, Cass, that's a funny thing, you mentioning money. Because I was just about to ask you for some.
You were going to ask me for money? Who the hell do you think you're dealing with? In case you didn't happen to notice it, you big Texas longhorn bull. I'm one hell of a gorgeous chick.
Well, now, Cass,
you
take
heard
it.
I got 28 years old. You think you can come up here and pull this kind of crap up here? Well, you're out of your mind.
Now, come on.
I can just kill you with my bare hands. Will you get out of here? Will you get out of here?
It was a small part. Did you realize it was going to be such a good role for you?
Well, you do get a feeling, as a matter of fact, not so much that you're going to get an award, but that all the vibes, I hate to use that word, sounds corny, but all the feelings that everybody has are meshing together. Everybody's working for ultimately one thing, the project that you're on. And you just have the sense that it's going to be good, not so much that you're going to get awards and so forth, but that the end result is going to be a very positive one. Yes, I had that feeling.
You're in a new movie directed by Paul Morrissey. You first worked with him in the Morrissey-Warhol movie Heat, which
right.
was an homage to Sunset Boulevard. You played a faded Hollywood star who's not
in
doing
which,
game
by the
shows.
Way, which, by the way, Artie Shaw insists that I was doing Lana Turner, whom I had never, you know, I had never even met Lana Turner. I mean, I was flattered that he thought that. And the interesting thing about it was I did the film specifically with Morrissey because I had seen Trash, which I'd been quite impressed with. I had already been nominated for Midnight Cowboy, Terry, when I did that film. And everybody said, why would you do something? Why would you risk and so forth?
But when they were saying, how would you risk that? What were they meaning? How would you go out of the mainstream into
exactly.
such an underground movie?
Exactly.
And take your clothes off for a sex scene?
Yes, but only, I would never do that. I mean, I did that in Midnight Cowboy. I would never do that if it were not in the total concept or
totally in
character. Just like, for example, it would be out of character to play a drunk and not drink, you know?
Well, you're working with Paul Morrissey again. You just finished his new movie, Spike of Bensonhurst. It's a comedy about new and old organized crime in Brooklyn. And you play a corrupt Jewish congresswoman from Brooklyn who even uses her grandson's bar mitzvah as an occasion to make speeches. Any research for this character?
Well, at the time that I was shooting it, research wasn't even necessary because it just seemed like all the newspapers were just loaded with women politicians. This, of course, is a comical, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily a cartoon, my part, but I would say it's a comical or clownish version of that, so that the humor will take the edge off of it being anybody in particular.
Constituents, friends of the bar mitzvah, as you know, as your congresswoman, I have fought long and hard against the infringement of our precious civil liberties by that recent attempt to require drug testing of our teachers, policemen, and firemen.
Give me a break.
This unspeakable and unwarranted intrusion upon the civil rights of our drug dealers. I mean our civil servants is the first step towards a complete and total fascist takeover of our free society. And what are they saying about
about me? That I protect the dope dealers? That I am mixed up with illicit substances? I ask you, are these the eyes of a substance abuser?
Since in your two new movies, Spike of Bensonhurst and Crossing Delancey, you play very Jewish characters, I should ask you if you're Jewish yourself.
I am, but that, by the way, those are the first two. I've always been playing Irish and Italian. I never get to play Jewish characters. As a matter of fact, I heard an interview with Lainey Kazan, and she was complaining that she's getting to play all these Jewish mothers, and I was thinking to myself, well, Lainey, I'll take a few of those, and you can you can have some of my other slapdash roles.
Most of your characters are eccentric in one way or another. Do you feel that you've spent most of your life outside of the mainstream?
No, I don't, because first of all, I was nominated Actress of the Year in Great Britain for Tennessee Williams' Biocare. In 1978, I did Night of the Iguana at Circle in the Square with Richard Chamberlain and Dorothy McGuire. These are all traditional classical plays. I've done my... on the contrary, actually, I'm a very well-trained conservative member. When I say conservative, I've lived here in New York. I've maintained my residence in one city for my whole life. I consider that very traditional, not at all. I think... I rather, if you're using eccentric in the way that they use it in England, I'll accept that, because that's individual or unique rather than peculiar. Do you see?
I see exactly what you mean.
I don't think a person is peculiar. If they are a character, that means they are a full-blown person that you can identify. They have a point of view. They have a vision of their own. They see things, and they're consistent with it.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you, Terry.
Sylvia Miles plays the matchmaker in the new film Crossing Delancey, and she co-stars in the forthcoming Paul Morrissey film Spike of Bensonhurst. This is Fresh Air. Renee Montaigne, the co-host of All Things Considered, is with us with a preview of what's coming up. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, we have a story today on President Reagan, who responded angrily to the assertion, which was made yesterday by Speaker of the House Jim Wright, that the CIA has attempted to provoke Nicaragua's Sandinista government into repressing the opposition there. Now, the president didn't deny it, but Reagan said that the speaker had no right to cite information revealed to him in a closed briefing. Also, I'll talk with political correspondent Linda Wertheimer about Michael Dukakis's proposed health plan, and we'll have a report about medicine in the military. It turns out military hospitals are running so short of resources that one out of three beds are now shut down, and in some hospitals, half the operating rooms closed.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When most of us want a glimpse of wildlife, we go to the local zoo. But writer Patricia Eakins taps an imaginary menagerie. Her first collection of stories about improbable beasts is called The Hungry Girls. Critic Stuart Klawans has this review.
When I was a child, I loved to read books about animals. Actually, I had them read to me with lots of sound effects. When I got a little older and graduated from Golden Books, I switched to medieval bestiaries. They were even better, full of animals nobody had ever seen. There were hippogriffs and manatees and something, I forget its name, that had the body of an ant and the head of a lion. The bestiaries were instructive, too. Every animal, no matter how unlikely, had a story attached to it, and every story had its moral. Patricia Eakins must have grown up on bestiaries, too, because every story in her new collection is about some sort of made-up animal. And, like the medieval writer, she is very moral about her creatures. Except, in her case, the morals tend to be a little disturbing. Consider the story of the Totojoni. These were clever little dogs kept in the sleeves of the ladies of the mythical Plum Blossom Court. Once during a time of crisis, the Empress found a new use for them. It seems that the deer, which lived in the Imperial Game Park, were no longer able to mate. So, the Empress taught her sleeve dogs a very complicated trick by which the dogs could help impregnate the does. The trick scandalized many of the ladies of the Plum Blossom Court, but it saved the deer, and many years later it even saved the dynasty. This is a very instructive tale, but what does it teach? Nothing all that reassuring. At the end, the emperor, who is not the good guy, just the winner, explains the secret of his success. All I had to do, he says, was follow my desires. And so it goes in the other stories. There is an ancient Greek king who marries a golden-haired monkey and is very happy with her, until his subjects realize their next rulers will be half-ape. In another tale, there are mutant dogs on a Pacific atoll who live off of radiation. And in still another, we encounter some nasty snakes in the Parsi city of Galub who slither all over a certain Fatima and make a saint out of her. As you may have gathered from all this, Patricia Eakins is fond not just of inventing strange animals, but also of impersonating writers from different periods and parts of the world. In Hungry Girl, she gives her impressions of Eskimo and Native American fables, Tibetan folklore, even the kiddie stories that I used to find in golden books. But as you may also have gathered, the fables are not really golden books material. Most of them are about strange mating rituals and violence, and whatever morals they have are not the sort of sentiment you'd want to stitch into a sampler and hang on the wall. Which brings me to the title story, the best of the collection. Hungry Girls is about a race of children born in France in the 1840s. The mother, a peasant, had taken to eating dirt since she had nothing else. And so the first hungry girl was born. She gnawed her way out of the mother's body, and within moments had caught a rat by the tail and was biting off its head. The girl would eat anything, porcelain clocks, andirons, embroidery frames. You could use her as a bank, just feed her money. And she was enormous, very useful for plowing the fields. I will stop before I get to the sexual history of the hungry girls. If you're above the age of golden books, you can read the rest of their story at your bookstore. Or you can order Hungry Girls from Cadmus Editions, Box 687, Tiburon, California, 94920.
Stuart Kluwans reviews film for The Nation magazine. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, short story writer and novelist Lori Colwin whets our appetites. Her new book is a collection of essays on the joys of home cooking, with titles like How to Disguise Vegetables and Repulsive Dinners, a memoir. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new album from Fishbone, a black rock band with a sharp political edge. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dead Ringers, the new film by David Cronenberg, who also gave us Scanners and the remake of The Fly. Dead Ringers is the story of identical twin gynecologists who become involved with the same actress. So hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salat, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.